It's Friday, November 25th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Coming up, unrest continues in Iraq and Syria as the battle against Islamic State rages on.
They are actually offering a new model of identification, and this model of identification is going back to the Golden Lands, even if they never existed.
Far-right candidates are gaining popularity. Also ahead, fires sweep through Israel, new lessons in farming, and a new musical keyboard. It's all on today's International Edition. A suicide truck bomb claimed by Islamic State killed at least 70 people at a gas station south of Baghdad on Thursday. Many of the victims were Iranian pilgrims who had taken part in a Shiite holiday in the Iraqi city of Karbala. Authorities say buses full of people were parked at the time and that numerous vehicles were torched by the force of the blast in the city of Hilla. The pilgrims were headed back to Iran after visiting Karbala. Reports also say Iraqi security forces were on high alert for the duration of the pilgrimage, seen as a potential target of Islamic State. The terror group considers Shiites to be apostates. The attack comes as Iraqi forces battle to retake the key city of Mosul from Islamic State militants. Since October 17th, Mosul has been under siege by forces trying to remove the IS fighters, who have controlled the city and other large swaths of Iraq for more than 2 years. Hundreds of thousands of civilians are believed to be trapped in Mosul, even as Iraqi forces have begun clearing neighborhoods in the city's east. In neighboring Syria, the United Nations says time is running out for the 275,000 inhabitants of the besieged northern city of eastern Aleppo, whose food stocks are depleted. The UN warns people will starve if aid convoys are not allowed into the city in the coming days. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The last food provided by the World Food Program was distributed to the trapped residents of eastern Aleppo days ago. Now, nothing is left. Repeated requests by the United Nations to send aid convoys into the city have been refused by one or more of the warring parties. Special advisor to the UN Special Envoy for Syria, Jan Egeland, says there are hopeful signs that all the necessary approvals may soon be forthcoming. He says the UN has received written approval in principle by the armed opposition groups in Aleppo. He says Russia has given its verbal support for aid to be delivered. He says he is waiting for written confirmation from Russia and for a positive response from the Syrian government for this very complex, dangerous operation to go ahead.
Courageous humanitarian workers will be able to go with hundreds of truck loads of medical equipment, food, and all of the other things needed in eastern Aleppo. And we are ready to evacuate hundreds of wounded to medical facilities in both West Aleppo and in opposition-held Idlib.
With the exception of a few short pauses in the fighting, eastern Aleppo has been under relentless aerial attacks by the Syrian government and its Russian ally. Egeland says every medical facility in the city has been hit. He says the UN is launching a system to try to stop the attacks from happening over and over again.
Of course, there then also has to be accountability for attacks. Under humanitarian law, it's war crimes to deliberately attack medical facilities.
The plan calls for the monitoring of hospitals, clinics, and other medical facilities to ensure they are only used to care for the wounded and sick. It also calls for these buildings to be clearly marked and for notifying the locality of these structures to all those using air warfare to avoid attacking them. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Also, a U.S. soldier was killed Thursday in an explosion caused by an improvised explosive device in northern Syria. U.S. Central Command says the blast occurred near Ain Issa. No other information, including the soldier's name or the nature of the incident, was released. U.S. troops, part of a multinational coalition, are in that region to fight the Islamic State group. Time now on International Edition to see what is trending online. And for that, our social media reporter, G. Abby Lee, is here in Studio 22. Hi, G.
Hi, Jim.
I hope you had a nice Thanksgiving.
Yeah, same to you. But let's begin with the online reaction to the Macy's Thanksgiving parade that we just heard about. So NBC's morning news program called The Today Show tweeted about it because the station broadcasts the annual event. All the characters that are in the parade also talked about it on Twitter, including, but not limited to, Elmo, Power Rangers, Pikachu, Mr. Peanut, and the legendary dance company, the Rockettes.
Oh, cool. Well, what else is trending?
As soon as Halloween was over, stores across the country started talking about Thanksgiving. And now that Thanksgiving is over, it's all about Christmas. President-elect Donald Trump is in the hot seat because his store is selling an ornament that costs $149.
That's a lot. Why is it so pricey?
Well, apparently because it's finished with 14-karat gold. But apart from that, it's a regular-sized ornament in the shape of a Make America Great Again hat. One user tweeted, "And the market for this $149 ornament are the people who said they voted for Trump because times are hard and the elites don't get it." Another user tweeted, "I'm thankful I'm Jewish because no matter how much we might disagree, no one is going to buy a Make America Great Again Christmas ornament." But some Trump supporters asked those who are critical of the pricing to not judge their decision of purchasing the ornament. Outside of Twitter, it attracted a series of joking reviews on Amazon.com.
I imagine. Well, is there anything else trending?
Yep. Just for $130, which is a little less than the ornament, you can buy a hipster nativity scene. The stable has solar panels, Mary is holding a latte, Joseph has a man bun, and they're both taking a selfie, by the way, and then the three wise men come bearing Amazon deliveries on Segways. Not gonna lie, I kind of want it for myself. Jim, back to you.
The Analysis G, and you may follow her on Twitter at GAbbyLee, myself at VOA Stevenson, and we also invite you to follow the International Edition stream at VOA_IE. Among the top stories that are trending in the world, South Africa's biggest union groups back Ramaphosa to succeed Zuma. Mood gets grimmer in Zimbabwe over Mugabe and diving economy. Uganda aims to triple tourists with help of better transport. Malayan musicians' peace caravan brings message of reconciliation. Ethiopia says it will free vintage plane aviators soon. You'll find expanded coverage of these stories and more at the voanews.com website. And take the news with you. If you have a smartphone, try our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. VOA's International Edition continues. The U.S. election victory of Donald Trump was warmly welcomed by far-right politicians across the globe, nowhere more so than in Europe, where a series of upcoming polls could deliver big shocks to established political parties. First up is Austria on December 4th, where, as Henry Ridgewell reports, European voters are poised to elect a far-right head of state for the first time since the Second World War.
Far-right presidential candidate Norbert Hofer is hoping to ride a global wave of insurgent populism to win the Austrian presidency on December 4th.
Dort, wo sich die Eliten von den Wählern entfernen.
Speaking earlier this month, he borrowed a key theme from Donald Trump's successful U.S. election campaign, saying that whenever the elites distance themselves from voters, those elites will be voted out of office. Hofer's far-right Freedom Party has warned of a civil war over migration. His extreme rhetoric is winning votes. Polls give him a slim lead over his rival, the Green Party's Alexander van der Bellen. European historian Andrea Mamone of Royal Holloway University of London says the far-right is connecting globally.
Politicians are playing with these fears. They are actually offering a new model of identification. And this model of identification is going back to the golden lands, even if they never existed.
In France, Marine Le Pen, the leader of the far-right National Front, has promised to turn back the clock to the days before the European Union and global free trade. She says Britain's vote to leave the EU and Trump's victory have given her momentum.
Les peuples britanniques et américains ont fait fi.
The British and the American people dismissed these patronizing campaigns, these campaigns of fear, she told reporters this week, adding, "I'm convinced that the French people can too." France's two-round election system has so far kept the far right out of power, but 2016 has shown that past voting patterns are a poor guide to modern politics, says Mamoni.
Many people are feeling that maybe it's worth voting for these protest movements because this vote might eventually count and this vote might eventually change things, or at least this vote may eventually shake power.
Critics point to a common ally of the far right on both sides of the Atlantic, Russian President Vladimir Putin. Russian banks have given Marine Le Pen multi-million dollar loans to fight her campaign.
Putin is willing to fund all these far right movements because not they can only make pressure in the European Union context, but I think that is also a matter of in national societies what they can say about Russia.
That sympathy for Moscow is echoed by the political opposition in Italy, which smells victory in a referendum scheduled December 4th on constitutional change, a result that could topple Prime Minister Matteo Renzi. In the Netherlands, the far-right Freedom Party tops the polls ahead of 2017 elections, despite the ongoing trial of its leader, Geert Wilders, on charges of inciting racial hatred. For now, all eyes are on Austria, which could deliver the first of a series of electoral earthquakes in Europe. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
Israeli firefighters were battling blazes around the country Thursday, including a massive fire in the mixed Arab-Jewish city of Haifa. Israeli officials blamed many of the fires on arsonists, whom they accused of terrorism. Several suspects have been detained. Sarah Miller is deputy editor at the Times of Israel news site. International Edition host Michael Lippin spoke with her on the phone just a while ago while she was in Jerusalem and asked her how bad the situation is.
It's pretty bad. In Haifa, which is the capital of the north and Israel's third largest city, between 60 and 70,000 people have been evacuated from their homes. 13 different neighborhoods have been evacuated and buildings are on fire. There's no power in a big chunk of the city. And people spent a large part of today trying to get out of the city, and there was gridlocks and panic and smoke and firefighters. It's been a bit of a hectic day.
Well, what do we know about where these evacuees are going and whether any people have been hurt?
About 100 people have been treated mainly for smoke inhalation. Thank heavens nobody has been badly hurt and there have been no fatalities. It's mainly smoke inhalation. The people who have been evacuated are being hosted by families in the area and in other parts of the country. People have really opened their doors. In ways, it's very reminiscent of the 2006, in one aspect, it's reminiscent of the 2006 war with Hezbollah in Lebanon, where people, there was a mass evacuation from the north, and people really opened their doors and hosted people who had to leave their homes. It's oddly reminiscent of that. And the most interesting thing is that the Islamic movement, which is in a lot of ways not seen as being particularly pro-Israel, and a lot of members of the Arab community have really gone the extra mile and made it very clear that they're willing to host people regardless of ethnicity. In a country where Jews and Arabs don't always see eye to eye, it's been quite, for want of a better word, heartwarming.
So the Islamic movement, for the benefit of our listeners, is a movement of Arab Israelis, a religious movement that promotes Islam in Israel, which has a big Arab minority. And I wanted to know how are Arab Israeli leaders reacting to comments by Israeli officials that many of these fires are being set deliberately by arsonists, and they describe those arson attacks as acts of terror, with the obvious implication being that terrorist attacks are committed by Arabs or Palestinians. So what is the response to that?
There's been a lot of anger. There have been a lot of indignant responses, and the head of the main Arab faction in the parliament, a man called Ayman Oda, made a very impassioned speech earlier today. He was in Haifa, and he said that this kind of phenomenon impacts on the Arab communities just as it does on the Jewish communities. And when there's a fire, the damage it causes, it does not discriminate. And as I said, the Arab community has been very quick to open its doors to everybody who's been affected by the fire.
Well, thank you very much to Times of Israel editor Sarah Miller for speaking to International Edition from Jerusalem.
Thank you.
Jerusalem's municipality has proposed the construction of 500 more housing units in the Ramat Shlomo settlement north of the city, an area annexed by Israel following the 1967 Mideast War and the first plan since the election of U.S. President-elect Donald Trump. Israel has been roundly criticized for its settlement policy, which is viewed as undermining a two-state solution with the Palestinians. Mustafa Barghouti, a Palestinian lawmaker, appealed to the president-elect to denounce the move.
The declaration of the establishment of 500 new settlement units is only the beginning of a very dangerous step to legalize and build more than 30,000 new settlement units in the area of Jerusalem. More than that, this Israeli government is planning to legalize and initiate 120 new settlements in addition to the 159 settlements. It is the responsibility of Mr. Trump and his administration to immediately tell Israel that they will not support this horrible violation of international law, since Israel is trying to claim that they have a green light from Mr. Trump and his administration.
Middle East analyst Stephen Zunis of the University of San Francisco tells VOA's Victor Beatty that the settlement activity outside Israel's internationally recognized border is widely regarded as illegal.
Settlements within the greater municipal boundaries of Jerusalem are even more controversial, given that the Palestinians would still hope to see that as the capital of their state. But the fact that the Israelis would go ahead with this particularly provocative settlement soon after Trump's election may not be coincidental. The incoming Trump administration has indicated they not only do not see these settlements as illegal, but they do not see them as an obstacle to peace. Furthermore, the Republican platform, for the first time in decades, does not come out in support of a Palestinian state alongside Israel. As a result, there are concerns that the Trump administration is siding pretty solidly with the Israeli government and is essentially giving up on the peace process of allowing the Palestinians to have a state of their own alongside Israel.
UN envoy Nikolai Mladenov told the Security Council on Wednesday the situation on the ground is changing steadily, dangerously, as proponents of Israeli settlement expansion feel emboldened, internal divisions among Palestinians flare up, and the prospect of a future Palestinian state comes under threat like never before.
I would have to agree with that. In fact, I was in the area where the new Israeli settlement is planned to be built. They had summarily torn down nearly 20 family homes, Palestinians that had been living in that area for generations. And it appears that this slow-motion ethnic cleansing, if you will, where Israeli colonists are being able to move into long-standing Palestinian areas in such a way that by physically surrounding East Jerusalem, the largest concentration of Palestinians, that they really are making any kind of contiguous West Bank state physically impossible.
Stephen Zunis warns the chances of another Palestinian uprising are increasing. In an interview almost a year ago, Donald Trump said if elected, he would know within 6 months of his presidency whether it was possible to achieve an elusive Israel-Palestinian peace. He said he doubts either side wants a resolution to their conflict and added that a lasting peace rests with Israel. You'll find more in this story and much more at our voanews.com website. Also, be sure to follow us on Twitter at @VOA_IE and on Facebook at VOA Now. You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
Hi, my name's Larry London. Welcome to Border Crossings, your request and dedication program here at the Voice of America. 1500 Universal, Monday through Friday, we're there for an hour playing your favorite music. You can send an email in and request your favorite songs by your favorite artists. You can also phone in as well. We have great contests and surprise guests from time to time. Border Crossings, every single day during the week at 1500 Universal, here on the Voice of America.
Do you lead a busy life? Not always able to catch your favorite VOA radio or TV program? If you are keen to stay in touch with world news and events, give VOA podcasts a try.
VOANews.com.
Visit our website at VOANews.com to learn how you can become a subscriber to VOA podcasts and keep your life up to date.
VOA News, your trusted source for news and information.
This is VOA's International Edition. If you're a musician, there's a brand new keyboard for you to try out. We'll find out in just a minute, but first, it's not unusual for people to change careers. James Fison is one of them, although 5 years ago he didn't imagine that he would be. With a law degree from Harvard, he was well into a career as a corporate lawyer in Miami. Then in 2012, his grandfather died, and Fison inherited his farm, so he quit his job and returned to Virginia to start a farm business. But instead of raising cattle or corn, he's raising incomes for local farmers. Faiza El-Masri has the story, narrated by Faith Lapidus.
James Fason is familiar with farm living. It's a family tradition.
My grandparents, Milton and Juanita Fason, were second-generation farmers, and my grandparents passed away and left the farms to my siblings and I. And so that started the process of sort of trying to figure out what we were going to do with the farms.
Gradually, Fason learned about the economic challenges facing small farmers.
A lot of small farmers are struggling, and they're working very hard, but they're not able to derive the income from farming to sort of make it economically viable. The issue with agriculture in America is we only spend 6.8% of our income on food, which is the lowest in any industrialized nation. And so, since we spend so little on food, we expect food to be inexpensive, which means in order to make a living doing it, you have to have really, really big volumes. And so having big volumes of anything can be very expensive in terms of having enough cattle, having enough hogs, or having enough infrastructure to support having those animals.
After meeting several farmers who raise animals without hormones, antibiotics, or steroids, Fason started Milton's Local, a company named after his grandfather. It was a very different work day than he'd had as an attorney.
Here, I'm not in the office. You know, I'm generally out on the road, either on farms or in grocery stores and restaurants, whereas in a corporate law environment, you're really in the office. The other thing is I did international corporate law, so a lot of my clients were from overseas. And I'll say 95% of my clients I never met in person ever. Whereas here, it's very personal. It's very much about getting those one-on-one relationships, at least at the beginning of the business relationship, so you can establish trust.
Milton's Local markets and distributes all-natural meat from local farms to wholesale clients, like restaurants and grocery stores. Fason says he's helping farmers increase their income, boosting the local economy, and satisfying the customers who buy these products.
When you're eating locally, you're able to sort of support that farmer who raised it, you support that store who sold them the feed, and it really has these sort of beneficial feedbacks where you're keeping more dollars in your community. The other part I think is people are really concerned about what's being put into animals. So I think about 73% of all antibiotics used in the U.S. are used on animals. So that's a really big problem, especially in terms of antibiotic resistance. So I think that both movements will continue to grow, and hopefully we'll be able to grow with them.
Mom's Organic Market in Arlington, Virginia, is one of the retailers that carry Milton's Local products. Store manager Chris Wolf says this grocery chain is committed to selling all natural organic products.
All the business decisions that we make are made in order to protect and restore the environment. We don't have any products that include high fructose corn syrup, artificial colors, artificial ingredients, nitrates, nitrites, things that are frequently found in meat.
Milton's local products have been sold at this store for over a year, and customers like them. That's not just because they're natural, but because they're produced by local farmers.
The farm is growing because we are demanding more, because our customers are demanding more.
That's good news for James Faison, who's currently working with about 36 small farms in Virginia and North Carolina. His goal for Milton's Local is to expand, generate higher profits, and help more small farmers. For writer Faiza El-Masri, I'm Faith Lapidus, VOA News.
The keys on a traditional piano have remained largely unchanged for hundreds of years, but now a piano-style synthesizer replaces those keys with a touch-responsive surface. As we hear from Deborah Block, the innovation opens up a new world of musical expression.
Unlike the black and white keys on a piano, the piano-style keyboard, known as C-board, is made from soft and springing materials. Launched in 2013 by a startup called Raleigh, its inventor, Roland Lamb, is a jazz pianist who has also created a compact synthesizer called Blox.
I wanted to be able to express more from the keyboard and, you know, create the kinds of sounds and modulations that people could create on a bass or a guitar or a saxophone. And I was sitting at the piano and thinking, why can't I strike a note and then, you know, glide it and slide it and move it?
This classical pianist is a fan of C-board, who says he is always discovering something new he can do.
This is the most expressive instrument I ever played. And, you know, and be able to use my piano technique and make that expressive changed my world.
Blox is Lamb's newest musical innovation. By applying various pressure on the block, the intensity of the sound changes. Made from a kit, Blox is designed so anyone can create a professional-sounding track.
What's exciting about Blox is that you both have that depth of expression with every touch, but it's completely open-ended because it's modular, so you can piece together a kit or a set that's just right for you.
Lamb says it would be hard for him to go back to playing a traditional piano.
Now that I know the possibilities that one can access through new technologies and new sounds, and you can still have a depth of expression and simplicity, but you can access like a whole world of possibilities.
Blox recently became available on Raleigh.com and on the Apple website and in Apple stores around the world. Deborah Block, VOA News, Washington.
You've been listening to International Edition. Check us out at voanews.com, on Facebook at VOA Now, and on Twitter at VOA_IE. Our director is Tracy Carter, engineer John Ellison. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions.
The fourth Thursday in November is a national day of Thanksgiving in the United States. The tradition is a very old one, dating back to the arrival of some of the earliest English settlers in North America in the 17th century, who, after their first successful harvests, paused to celebrate their bounty and give thanks for surviving their first terrible winter in what was then a wilderness. Falling in the autumn, Thanksgiving has much in common with harvest holidays in other nations and cultures, such as Vietnam's Trung Thu celebration and Hô Mô Wô, the annual yam festival in Ghana. Still, with its turkey dinners, family gatherings, football games, and parades, there's something about the day that is distinctively American. Together with the 4th of July, when the U.S. marks its independence from Great Britain, it's a truly national holiday that includes all citizens in a common purpose, regardless of religious, political, or ethnic persuasion. It also is a time for people to look back at the year, take stock, and think about the future. With our nation dealing with crises in Eastern Europe, the Middle East, and West Africa, the year's looming uncertainties likely will be on many minds today. President Abraham Lincoln proclaimed the first official Thanksgiving amid similar serious circumstances, the American Civil War. But like their colonial ancestors, Americans are essentially an optimistic people. Surrounded by friends and family, today is in the past, they will enter into the spirit of the day, giving thanks for life's blessings and the promise of the future living in a free land.
That was an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials. It's